From the weekly studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. In 2015, the EPA proposed the Clean Power Plan, a set of rules and regulations that designed to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases being emitted by coal-fired power plants.
But just 2 weeks ago, that same agency canceled this plan, saying that it's overreached its regulatory authority. In its place, the EPA is proposing to replace it with something called the Affordable Clean Energy Rule.
Lissa Lynch is a staff attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council, and she joins us in the first half of the show to explain the Clean Power Plan, why it was repealed, and what's different about the proposed Affordable Clean Energy Rule.
Then in the second half of the show, we have some news highlights for you. We'll be talking about a new coral reef recently found off the coast of the eastern U.S., as well as what's happening with the proposed grizzly bear hunt here in the western U.S.
Wow, those are two very disparate news items.
They are.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, both pretty interesting.
And I got an item about climate change and how warm our cities are becoming. There was an article in the New York Times about that. And I looked into Salt Lake City, and it's some really interesting information about it. Not only how many more 90-degree days that are occurring over the last 30 or 40 years, but how many cold or how fewer cold days are also happening. I put the information together. We'll share it with you.
You heard it here first.
Later in the show. Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what this Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Steve Roney Jr. from Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. We are a proud supporter of KPCW and our Park City community. Our agents are located in Summit and Wasatch counties, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com or 649-7171.
Support for KPCW comes from Rocky Mountain Power, working to make renewable energy available to every Utahan. Learn about the new subscriber solar program and other renewable energy choices at utahsolarworks.com.
Dr. Bob Miller here from Miller Orthodontics. We are longtime supporters of The Local View and The Randy Barton Show. Did you know some headaches are related to bite issues? More information on headache relief options are at m2ortho.com.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us on the phone is our first guest, Lissa Lynch. She's a staff attorney with the Climate and Clean Energy Program with the Natural Resources Defense Council. And she's joining us to help us understand why the EPA recently dropped their proposed Clean Power Plan and is proposing to replace it with something called the Affordable Clean Energy Rule. Lissa, thank you for joining myself and Nell on This Green Earth.
Thank you for having me.
All right, well, let's start with some background on the Clean Power Plan itself. This is something that was put forward back in 2015, correct?
That's right. And the Clean Power Plan was the first time that the federal government had set standards for carbon pollution from power plants. There are other regulations limiting other pollutants, but this is the first time for carbon pollution that is one of the biggest sources contributing to climate change from the United States.
Okay. So what was some of the major pieces of this plan?
Sure. So the Clean Power Plan would have cut power plant carbon pollution 32% by 2030 from 2005 levels. And the way that EPA was proposing to do that was that they looked at the power sector and how the power industry was already reducing its emissions. And they essentially identified three different building blocks, they called them, or sort of buckets, of strategies that the power sector was using. So the first was making improvements at coal-fired power plants themselves. The second was reducing dirtier generation in favor of cleaner gas generation. And the third was reducing dirtier fossil generation in favor of zero-emitting solar and wind. So they calculated what could be achieved through all of those strategies and then set the target based on that. The rule, as you said, came out in 2015 and was challenged, you know, almost immediately by coal states and a number of power sector industry groups and individual power companies. It was also defended by a whole host of other states and power companies and NGOs. And so that litigation got started first in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, but then went up to the Supreme Court basically on a petition from the groups that were challenging it that asked the Supreme Court to put the rule on hold while the litigation was going on so that everything legally could get sorted out before the rule went into effect. Very unusual, but the Supreme Court did issue that stay of the rule in February 2016, and so the Clean Power Plan has actually not been implemented.
However, I've read that despite the fact that it wasn't officially implemented, some of the intended impacts were still taking place. We were still seeing a drop in emissions. Is that right?
Yeah, that is right. So the CPP had set that 2030 deadline to reach a 32% carbon pollution reduction below 2005 levels. The power sector, as of 2017, has already decreased its emissions by about 28%. So that's 13 years ahead of the deadline, and that is as a result of rapidly decreasing clean energy costs and just general decarbonization throughout the power industry as a result of market forces. But that's not nearly enough to avert the worst of climate change. I mean, we're seeing right now what climate change looks like in real time. You know, the last 4 years have been the hottest on record. There are deadly heat waves occurring all over the world, intensifying extreme weather, larger wildfires, major flooding. So honestly, instead of throwing out the Clean Power Plan, what EPA should be doing is strengthening it to protect our health and our climate.
Right. So again, if I understand this correctly, the Clean Power Plan, among other things, set kind of these bars and goals and then asked each state to put together a plan of action to meet these standards?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's right. So the plan set emission rates that coal plants and gas plants would need to meet throughout the country. Then they also provided basically a limit for each state that was converted based on those two rates, and then turned it over to the state to design plans to meet those targets. And the states could use trading programs and averaging and a whole host of flexible compliance strategies that were largely based on the kinds of either state programs or multi-state cap and trade programs that already exist mm-hmm. throughout the country.
So tell us which states were, you know, lobbying in support of this and which states were fighting against it.
Sure. So you had almost every state lined up on one side or the other. The states that opposed the Clean Power Plan were largely the states that have a lot of coal generation in them or are coal-producing states. So West Virginia was kind of the lead ringleader of the state coalition, but they were joined by, you know, other Midwest coal-heavy states and Western coal-producing states. On the other side, you had the New England and Mid-Atlantic states, which are engaged in the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, REGGI, which is a market-based cap-and-trade program. You have California, which also has its own cap-and-trade program, mm-hmm. and then a whole host of other states that have their own carbon reduction plans or strategies that they've tried to implement in, you know, in their own states. And what you've actually seen following the stay of the Clean Power Plan and following the Trump administration's withdrawal from the Paris Agreement is that a number of those states have kept up the fight and kept up the effort to reduce carbon pollution, even though the federal government is no longer leading, and now it seems it's trying to actively thwart reductions in pollution.
Right. But again, and both you and Nell stated this, that it seemed like the use of coal, burning coal to produce electricity, has decreased since, well, probably going back to 2012 or 2013. We've seen coal-fired power plants being retired one after another. And a lot of that is not necessarily being driven by increasing regulations, per se, state or federal regulations, but by the market itself, as you said, Lissa, in terms of natural gas prices being much more competitive in producing electricity versus coal and wind and solar, et cetera. So it's the market that seems to be primarily driving this reduction in the use or need of coal-fired power plants.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so
thank you.
So and that continues because even when this the Clean Power Plan was introduced in 2015, a lot of utilities, a lot of the industry said, you know what, we still think that natural gas, and we've had stories on this show about how wind and solar in certain regions of the country are cheaper than coal. So that's where we're headed, and we're just going to move forward with cleaner forms of energy. With or without the Clean Power Plan in place. So that was the EPA of the prior administration. Now let's turn our attention to the existing administration, which has declared, this EPA has declared that the prior EPA overreached its bounds, basically, with the Clean Power Plan. Is that one way of putting it?
It is. And in fact, one of the leading voices against the Clean Power Plan under the prior administration was none other than Scott Pruitt, the former Attorney General of Oklahoma, mm-hmm. who then, as we know, became the administrator of the EPA.
Right.
And so their argument, when this was in court, and we did, you know, fully brief that litigation, and it went to oral argument. It was a 7-hour oral argument before all of the judges on the D.C. Circuit. So we really did hash out the legal issues pretty extensively, but the court just hasn't decided them. And so the opponent's main argument was that by considering the emission reduction strategies that occur outside of the physical plant itself, that EPA had overstepped its bounds, and EPA was limited to only considering what could be physically accomplished at a power plant itself. And so, lo and behold, Scott Pruitt becomes EPA administrator, and that's exactly what they proposed earlier this year in a separate proposal. The Pruitt EPA proposed to repeal the Clean Power Plan on that legal basis, that it had gone too far in thinking about the emission reductions that could be achieved using strategies other than anything that's, you know, physically at the coal plant itself. And so this, the ACE rule, the Affordable Clean Energy proposal, is a follow-on to that proposal that, you know, limits the scope of what EPA considers to only what can be physically accomplished at a coal plant. Now, I cannot help but note that it is almost comical that they're calling this the affordable clean energy rule.
Affordable for who?
Right. It does nothing to reduce pollution or promote clean energy, and it honestly could actually increase pollution and end up costing more than the Clean Power Plan.
So walk us through some of the bullet points of this proposed affordable clean energy rule and how it would work.
Sure. So the proposal has kind of three big major changes to what the prior EPA was trying to do. The first is that EPA is proposing to just hand regulatory authority entirely over to the states and give them free rein to set weak emission standards on coal plants or to decline to limit a plant's emissions at all. And this is a major departure from the way that this normally works, where EPA sets a target and then the states design plans to meet that target. That's one piece. The second, then, is that EPA is proposing that when the state is setting emission limits on coal plants, they can only be based on these heat rate improvements, which are basically minimal efficiency upgrades at the coal plants themselves. And so they're ignoring this massive shift that we've been talking about toward cleaner energy that's already happening in the power sector and going back to a more expensive and less effective plant-by-plant approach. Now, the thing that's important to know about this is heat rate improvements increase the efficiency of a coal plant, and that makes it a little less expensive to operate. And the result can be that the plant gets called upon to run more often and ends up emitting more pollution in total overall. So this leads to the third piece of this proposal, which is a broad revision to another Clean Air Act program, the New Source Review Permitting Program. And this revision is designed so that coal plants can actually increase their annual emissions without triggering that program, which would otherwise have required them to install modern pollution controls. So the proposal itself acknowledges that the result of these strategies that they're talking about could actually result in increased emissions and, in fact, needs other changes in other parts of the Clean Air Act requirements in order to enable plants to increase their emissions.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Lissa Lynch. She's a staff attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council under their Climate and Clean Energy Program. We're talking about the recent move by the EPA to kind of pull off the table the Clean Power Plan that was introduced back in 2015 and replace it with a new proposal called the Affordable Clean Energy Rule. So, Lissa, given those three changes, or let's call them the three parts of the scope of the Clean Energy Rule, the most interesting one to me is that is the first one you mentioned, that we kind of hand over to the states, give them the latitude to come up with any plan they want, almost, including, well, it's not really viable for us to do any kind of reduction in coal-fired power plants right now or carbon emissions right now. It's like you say, it gives the states the latitude to make the call on what they want to do without the EPA really saying yay or nay to it.
That's right. And it also remains kind of murky what is an approvable plan,
right?
You know, what an approvable plan would look like. And so EPA does have the ultimate responsibility to approve or disapprove of a state plan, but they're not giving any guidelines or guardrails, really, mm-hmm. about what is or is not approvable, because they're not setting any particular target. They're just handing it over to the states to, you know, set some kind of target, perhaps a different target for each of their coal plants, or perhaps, you know, nothing at all.
Now, has there been any response to this from, you know, from the energy or fossil fuel industries? I have to think that having different state-by-state regulations could be a challenge for some of these larger companies. And has there been any discussion around that?
Yeah. So after the announcement of the proposal, there was a quick S&P Global analysis that identified there's more than 36 coal units that are set for retirement before 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And none of those plans are changing. So spokesperson after spokesperson from different utilities confirmed that this proposal won't change any of those retirement decisions. You know, utilities are making really long-term investments when they're deciding whether to build a gas plant, whether to invest in, you know, a bunch more solar and wind, and whether to retire an old inefficient coal plant. And they need certainty in order to make those decisions. And this rule just doesn't give it to them. As we've been talking about, EPA is not setting any guardrails on the highway.
Right.
And so the utilities will just have to wait and see what the state will come up with for them, and then wait some more to see if EPA will approve or disapprove that plan. And that's a big gamble for them to take in the face of these market forces that are making coal less and less attractive and making cleaner generation much cheaper.
So what does this affordable clean energy rule say about clean energy, renewable energy sources?
Absolutely nothing. this really is a coal plant focused proposal, and it says virtually nothing about cleaner energy. It says virtually nothing about climate change. You know, this really is not a clean energy rule. It's really not even a pollution reduction rule. It is simply a propping up failing coal plants and trying to help them last a little longer in this market that is, you know, driving them out of business.
And I also have this the summary sheet about the ACE that goes through timing and the schedule. Here's an example of how they've updated their schedule for states to submit these plans. EPA is proposing to provide states 3 years to develop state plans. EPA action. Under the proposal, EPA would then have 12 months to act on a complete state plan submitted. And then EPA would have 2 years after a finding of the failure to submit a complete plan or disapproval of a state plan to issue a federal plan. So there is some vague wording in here to suggest that in the event that a state doesn't submit a plan or is incomplete, the EPA would have 2 years to perhaps issue a federal plan. But when you add all these things together, these states or this implementation of this plan could take as long as 4 or 5 years to put into play anyway. So they're extending the schedule of action.
Right. It's quite a ways out. And those timelines don't begin until the rule is finalized.
Ah, that's a good point.
And that could take quite a bit longer as well. So this proposal that just came out is a proposed rule. EPA now needs to hold public hearings and take public comment on this proposal. And then they need to consider all that public input in finalizing the rule. And only when they issue the final rule will those timelines start to take effect. And that's also when litigation can begin. And so if the EPA finalizes a rule that looks like this proposal, then we will almost certainly be challenging it in court as, you know, just an evasion of EPA's responsibility under the Clean Air Act to reduce pollution.
Give us an idea how long this process takes, the feedback and consideration and approval.
So the proposal includes a 60-day period for public comment. We and I expect others as well will be asking for an extension of that time. I think there's a lot going on in this proposal, especially the revisions to the new source review permitting program that are kind of snuck in the end of this proposal that's a whole other regulatory proposal in one. So there's essentially two different rulemakings here. 60 days is just not enough time for us, for the states, for the power companies to really wrap our heads around what all this means. So we'll be asking for an extension of that time, as well as more public hearings, so that, you know, the public can have a say in what EPA does. Normally, the period from, you know, end of the public comment period to finalization is quite long, and the agency is obligated to actually respond to the comments that they receive and articulate why they have or have not made the changes that those comments suggest. That being said, when an agency has already made up its mind, it may take not very long at all for them to finalize the rule.
Right.
However, that makes them much more legally vulnerable when it comes to challenges to the rule. If they haven't fully articulated their reasoning, not only for doing what they've done, but for rejecting the suggestions that they've received, then, you know, their rule is much more legally vulnerable in the end.
Now, has NRDC done some, I guess, economic forecasting, looking at the cost of this versus the benefits that are discussed? You know, I mean, there are impacts outside of course, in the energy sector, I imagine, with health and climate impacts and things like that.
Yes. And what is, one of the things that's interesting in the, there's a regulatory impact analysis that accompanies the proposal that EPA did. And they do a lot of different, you know, analyses of different illustrative scenarios, they call them, sort of possible ways that this thing could get implemented. But as we've talked about, there's really no certainty about how the states will choose to regulate or even whether they will. And so the range of costs and benefits that you're looking at is really difficult to parse. By EPA's own analysis, this proposal could end up causing up to 1,600 premature deaths a year in 2030.
Right.
And that's due to the rollback of the Clean Power Plan's protections and the increases in emissions that would occur relative to the Clean Power Plan. So, you know, EPA is admitting that this thing is going to cost additional lives. The cost analyses are very challenging to parse as well. What we're seeing, because of the rapidly declining costs of clean energy, is that the Clean Power Plan is declining in cost compared to what EPA had forecast back in 2015. So the costs of the Clean Power Plan are rapidly approaching sort of business as usual as the power sector decarbonizes. And so then what you end up with is, from this proposal, is increased pollution, and that causes increases in public health and environmental costs as more and more people get sick, more and more people lose days of work, or days of school, more people need to visit hospitals, mm-hmm. and ultimately more people end up dying.
Well, one thing we can be rest assured on is that, like you said earlier, Alyssa, 36 coal-fired power units are set to retire by 2020 around the country. And like you say, those are utility-based decisions. And they made those decisions a while ago, and usually those remain in play, no matter what plan is put in play by the EPA. And that's the most encouraging thing, again, as the market seems to control what utilities choose to burn or use to produce electricity in this country. So
that's right. And I think that the Clean Power Plan rollback needs to be seen in the context of the larger deregulatory effort by the Trump administration, alongside the forthcoming reconsideration of the mercury and air toxic standards,
right,
and the proposed rollback of standards for vehicle emissions and fuel efficiency. This is all part of a common thread that this administration is putting industry and polluters and their profits ahead of the climate and the air that we breathe. And so fortunately, you know, as you just said, although these proposals are trying to throw old coal plants a lifeline, hopefully even that is not going to be enough for them to compete with the steeply declining, you know, renewable technology costs and the low natural gas prices that we're seeing today.
Well, if as we start to wrap up here, if listeners are interested in commenting, how can they do that and how can they get involved?
Sure, they can go to EPA's website and submit comments that way. They can also visit NRDC All In on our website, nrdc.org, to see actions that they can take in addition to submitting comments. They can also, you know, reach out to elected officials and encourage them to weigh in. So we need everyone who's concerned about climate, everyone who's concerned about clean air, to weigh in. It's, you know, it's a lot. There's a lot of proposed rollbacks. There's a lot going on, both in the environmental space and, of course, in all of the other news. But this administration and this EPA need to hear from people who care about the air that they breathe and the climate that we leave to our children.
Well said. Lissa Lynch, she's staff attorney with the Climate and Clean Energy Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council. That's nrdc.org. Lissa, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, let's take a break for a couple underwriters. And when we come back, we got some news items to cover.
That's right. We'll be hearing about a proposed grizzly bear hunt here in the West and how that's going, as well as a new coral reef being found off the South Carolina coast.
And how many more 90-degree days can you expect over the next coming decades? We got
email
to
us
it
with
out.
Your get with your guests.
Send it to Nell, and we'll be right back on This Green Earth.
Hello, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage pickup provider, and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. Garbage and recycling containers should be placed at the curb before 7 a.m. on your scheduled collection day. Keep Summit County green. SummitCounty.org/recycle.
Hi, this is Whitney Ryan from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise recently committed to a net zero footprint by 2030. The environment is our business. By 2030, we commit to zero net emissions, zero waste to the landfill, and a zero net operating impact to forests and habitat. More information at epicpromise.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And we've got some news highlights for you now in the second section of the show today. And one of these has to do with changing temperatures, with climate change. And Chris has some numbers for us about how many really hot days and really cold days we are having.
Yeah, this comes actually, the motivation for me to do this came from an article in the New York Times where you actually go online and you enter in the city that you live in and they tell you or when you were born, mm-hmm. you enter in when you were born in what city and they tell you how many 90 degree days or greater that city experienced back when you were born. Let's say me, 1960 or so. And then they'll
or
tell
so,
you
know.
Or so. Actually, 59. And so a whole nother decade I have. And then they tell you how many 90-degree days have been occurring presently, and then they kind of predict how many 90-degree days or greater will occur. So,
and they have some neat visuals on there, too, a cool map. It's kind of fun to hop on and play around
right,
with.
Right, so enter in nearly any city.
Yeah, they had the town I grew up in, and that
really?
Was a small one. So
okay.
Your chances are good.
Is it getting warmer?
It is getting warmer.
In a word?
Yes.
That's the word.
Confirmed.
Every city is getting warmer. So I typed in Salt Lake City, and there they said back in 1960, they experienced 32 days of 90 degrees or warmer.
Okay, 32 days.
And today, currently, Salt Lake City is experiencing 41 days of 90 degree days or warmer. So an increase of almost like roughly 25%. Now,
that's huge.
Now, if you recall, several years ago, I was working with the PCCAP students, and we did a project which looked at temperature trends in Salt Lake City from all the way back to the 30s and 40s and 50s, and we mapped them out.
And I think it's worth pointing out the reason Salt Lake City was selected by the group was because we didn't have that data going back for Park City.
Correct.
So Salt Lake City is kind of acting as a, you know, for us located in the summit in Wasatch counties.
It's representative of this area. And so they have a weather station at the Salt Lake City International Airport that's been there for decades and decades and decades. And so I went into this data that's already the girls that helped me put it on there. By the way, I ran into one of them, a Sienna, last week. And she graduated from Park City High. She's at Westminster College right now. And you know what she's studying?
Environmental science?
Yes.
Oh,
environmental,
I love it.
Science. Fantastic. Good job, Sienna. And anyway, the work that Sienna and her cohorts did, we looked at the number of 90-degree days. And it's kind of different from what the New York Times suggested. But let me just run this by you. In the 1960s, I did this by decades. During the 60s, in Salt Lake City, there are roughly 60 days of 90 degrees or greater, okay? And then it actually dropped down and got cooler in the 1980s. So in the 1980s, there were 52 days of 90 degrees days or greater. Now, in the 2010s, this decade, there's 64 90 degrees. And that kind of makes sense because I was going through the data, and you look at Salt Lake City these last four or five summers, nearly every day in July and most of August and most of June, it was 90 degrees or more. It's common. So mm-hmm. That's how they got to averaging 64 days. So between 1980 at 52 and in 2010s at 64, that's 13 days more of 90 degree days, roughly a 20% increase.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the other thing we looked at. How many days was the temperature 32 degrees or less?
So
how
many, as a high.
As a high. How many days did it not reach freezing?
I think is especially interesting in colder climates or mid climates where you're looking at snow and thinking about snow accumulation and time where you have snow on the ground.
Right.
It's an important indicator also for like forest health and pests and things along those lines.
Right. It has an ecosystem impact. So mm-hmm. Let's look at that. In the 1980s, this is Salt Lake City International Airport, they experienced 25 days on average where the temperature did not get above freezing. Okay, so 25 days during the winter. During this decade, the 2010s, it is now down to 20.
Okay.
So a reduction of 5 days. Again, or roughly 20%. A 20% reduction in both the cold days that are their experience and then a 20% increase in the really, really warm days. So that's what's going on in Salt Lake City. And again, you can make that correlation, draw that line up to this area too, because Brian McInerney with National Weather Service has said that what goes on and down in Salt Lake City with respect to temperature probably goes on similarly, trends occur similarly all around northern Utah. So that's really that makes sense to me.
Yeah,
and we're seeing in a warmer world.
I remember when you guys did do that analysis that you found that more of the change was taking place on the lowest lows, if I remember correctly.
Lowest lows, and generally the nighttime lows were mm-hmm. were increasing at a greater rate than daytime highs.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't cooling off.
Right.
At night.
Also part of the difference we feel, which is pretty interesting.
And then again, that has a big difference on ecosystems. They don't get to cool off as much at night. And it can have a big difference in snowmaking operations.
Yeah.
They don't get temperatures below, I think they prefer temperatures around 28 degrees to make good snow.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to see fewer and fewer of those types of days. So that's what's going on with our temperature trend analysis. Thanks for joining us on that one.
Yeah. And if you want to fiddle around with the map, you can hop on NewYorkTimes.com. And the headline is just, how much hotter is your hometown than when you were born? And all they give is that 90-degree temp at this point. But it's kind of fun to look at.
All right. Let's take one break, and we'll come back and continue with the news items. That's the deal?
Sounds good.
And we'll be right back. It's This Green Earth.
Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands. SUWA and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the SUWA website at suwa.org.
Okay, we're back. This Green Earth, doing some news items. And what's the next one now?
So this is about one of our kind of iconic, I guess, Western species, the grizzly bear, which had been previously listed as threatened and endangered. And a federal judge in Montana just this past Thursday issued a court order temporarily blocking the first trophy hunts of the Yellowstone area grizzly bears in more than 40 years. And it's at this point, it's just a 14-day restraining order by the district judge in Missoula, Montana. And it just came a couple of days before Wyoming and Idaho were scheduled to open licensed grizzly bear hunts, allowing as many as 23 bears in the two states to be shot and killed for sport.
Mm-hmm.
Montana, however, chose not to open a hunting season for the bears because of concerns about its importance in kind of like as a Western icon, mm-hmm. and in tourism and, you know, photography and wildlife watching and all those things that grizzly bears are so beloved for. So Wyoming and Idaho had been scheduled to open their hunting season for grizzlies. Of course, that would be outside of Yellowstone National Park.
Right.
That would have started on Saturday.
But, so it's been stayed for 14 days, 2 weeks.
Yep.
While some additional information is gathered, a judge has more time to
exactly.
Make a
so this judge Dana Christensen has heard the arguments and needs time to decide. But he said when he granted the restraining order that the conservation and tribal groups who brought this suit had shown that they were, quote, likely to succeed on the merits of their lawsuit. So he sees them holding a strong case. As far as these hunting seasons. And these groups are essentially saying, right, that this bear shouldn't have been delisted in the first place because there aren't enough to consider it a really stable, healthy species.
Right. That's always been a big source of point of contention.
Yeah.
They're saying that we need the bears haven't reached a sustainable population, whereas
right.
other groups say that they have. Over the decades.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
hunting is simply going to not what the number you said 23.
Yeah, as many as 23 could be killed
in that one particular state.
In
the two states.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
and for context, there are 2,000 bears. Or fewer than 2,000 bears in
right.
the lower 48 states right now.
Oh, in the
compared
lower 48.
To a historic high of 100,000 before the extermination campaigns brought their numbers to just several hundred by 1975. And then they were listed by the Endangered Species Act and have started to rebound. And so, you know, the folks that say they should be delisted and that we should hunt them are saying, hey, they've rebounded from a few hundred to, you know, 1,700 or so. They're doing just fine. And then on the other side, the scientists are saying, well, when you look at, you know, when you consider things like genetic diversity and connectivity of populations and ability to rebound to, you know, natural disasters or other unfortunate circumstances, there aren't enough. Especially if they're being hunted. So it's an interesting one to watch, and we should see that ruling within the next couple of weeks.
Okay. It's amazing to think that grizzlies in one form or another populated virtually every state in the West.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Including
they were everywhere.
Including these forests. Yes. Here, there were grizzlies.
And then one other piece of this that is important to consider is the Native American point of view. Mm. They're saying that grizzlies are essential to protecting their religious and spiritual freedoms and their treaty rights in the Yellowstone area. That's a quote from Stan Greer, chief of the Piikani Nation and president of the Blackfoot Confederacy Chiefs. He says this sacred being is considered to be a deity by many tribes and not a rug. I've seen people referring to this as, instead of trophy hunting, rug hunting.
Oh, rug hunting.
Yeah, which is
you're right.
Kind of hard to stomach, but it is, you know, not a species that's eaten for food. It's mounted on a wall.
Right. It's strictly sport. Okay, so that's the latest. When we'll have more news, we'll follow that. But
yeah.
When the judge makes his final decision in roughly 2 weeks on whether to allow these groups to move forward. With the hunting. Again, that's in Wyoming and you said Idaho?
Yes. Wyoming and Idaho and Montana decided not, despite the fact that they could have opened a season, they decided against it because of concerns about maintaining a healthy grizzly population into the future. Oh. So interesting to see that play out.
And again, this doesn't include grizzlies who reside within federal lands, parkland.
Right.
Like Yellowstone or...
Right. And I believe there was a small buffer, a small non-hunting buffer put in place immediately outside the park.
But as soon as that bear steps out of that park,
exactly.
It's game on.
Game on.
They've got wanted posters.
Yeah. And there's also kind of an emotional connection, I think, that might be stronger for this species than some others, because some of these bears have been studied for decades. And so individual bears are known really, really well for, you know, the 20 offspring that they've had and the lives that they lived. And people feel like they know these bears, you know.
There's an emotional connection to them.
It's not just sort of like a nameless grizzly. It's like, oh, we know this one specific female. And
Here's their lineage and their family tree as such. That's interesting, too. All right. We'll follow that. We got like four
just
more
like
minutes.
A couple minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Do you want to do their South Carolina?
Yeah.
Cool. Let's keep going.
All right. So this was kind of a fun news piece to come along in our email. A new deep sea coral reef was discovered off the South Carolina coast. Mm. And I think it's just not often these days that you hear that something new was discovered, especially to this extent. They're saying at this point, they don't know everything, right? It stretches for at least 85 miles.
Wow.
And it's likely the keystone source of that region's fisheries. So like every coral reef, you know, the current coral that's alive and functioning is sort of building and building and building on top of other millennia worth of coral that have built this massive structure, this massive reef. And so it's a huge ecosystem that, again, has probably been developing for a few hundred thousand years. And so now they'll be starting, you know, to look at the health of this, what impacts it's having.
Does it say
doing additional research?
Yeah, how they discovered it? Was it?
Yeah, yeah. It was discovered by a research vessel called Atlantis, and it was exploring some 160 miles off the coast of Charleston, and it had, I think, if I'm remembering this right, kind of multiple purposes to being out there. They wanted to map, uncharted canyons in the ocean, gas seeps. And then also look for coral ecosystems. So it kind of had multi-purpose being out there.
Is this a shallow reef? I think you said it's a deeper.
It's deep.
A
it's
deep
a deeper
reef.
Deep sea reef. I don't know exactly
the depth
deep.
Or mm-hmm. where it is exactly.
Yeah, about 160 miles off the coast.
But it's a critical, among other things, a critical nursery
right.
for a lot of marine life. In and around that area.
Right. It provides that habitat diversity. And like you said, that provides a great place for a nursery for young species to start growing. The other thing that, of course, the conversation immediately transitions to is, right, the Trump administration is proposing expansive offshore drilling plan and energy development. So how does this impact that? Can this be a protected area? Will this impact the plan? And how will the reef be impacted by energy
development? Sounds like a candidate for a national monument.
Oh, interesting.
As an option.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's really, it's incredible now that, you know, we spend, this is my quick rant on space exploration. We spend tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars trying to confirm whether there's water on Mars when we're still discovering incredibly important life ecosystems, you know, off our coasts, in our oceans. We still don't probably understand less than, I'll throw a venture guess, less than 10% of what's going on in our oceans and how important a role they play in our lifestyles today, going on right now.
Right.
You know, that fishery industry, South Carolina, Georgia, North Carolina, are probably incredibly dependent upon that deep sea reef.
Right, without even knowing it.
Now they do, and we should make better efforts to, as you're saying, to research it, study it, and protect and conserve it. That's money well spent, as far as I'm concerned. All right. Any other news items? Can we finish there?
Yeah, time to wrap up.
All right, let's take one more break, and we'll come back and wrap up. It's This Green Earth.
Hi, this is Carolyn from Recycle Utah. Did you know that Recycle Utah preserves our watershed by keeping hazardous waste out of the landfill? At our fall collection day, we accept household waste such as paint, solvents, batteries, car fluids, fertilizers, chemicals, and more. It's free for Summit County residents on September 29th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Canyons parking lot. Recycle Utah is your local nonprofit recycling drop-off center, bringing water conservation ideas to you for over 25 years, and we support KPCW.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by the generosity of our Broadcasters Club. KPCW would like to recognize Broadcasters Club members Rich and Janice Sontag, Jeff and Carol Stoll, Jennifer Strahan, and Tom Biersbach. Thank you for making KPCW the community connection in Summit and Wasatch counties.
Hey, it's time to wrap things up on This Green Earth. Let's first thank our guest we had in the first part of the show, Lissa Lynch. She's a staff attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council, talking about the proposed Affordable Clean Energy Rule, which would replace the former proposed Clean Power Plan, both from the EPA of different administrations. Go to nrdc.org and learn more about those two plans. Thanks to her again for joining us. And of course, we want to thank our underwriters.
That's right. As always, thanks to Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance,
Vail Epic Promise,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
Park City Mountain.
And of course, always, listeners like you, you help make this show go with your thoughts and ideas for guests or, let's say, books you want us to read. And authors you'd like to get on environmental issues, let us know. How do they do that, Nell?
Shoot us an email at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org and tell us what you'd like to hear.
Yeah. Remember, this is KPCW 91.7 FM Park City.
Remember, we've got your Wasatch back.
Thanks again for joining us. And NPR News is coming up in about 20 seconds.